If you hate political correctness, you're going to love this. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Corey Bernardi, and thanks for joining me on another weekly dose of common sense podcast. I love creating these podcasts, and it's clear from the feedback many of you enjoy getting them as well. But every week, we send out an email that also links to my blog. It links to the podcast. It provides an update on the Australian Conservatives news story. And sometimes we also promote one of the things that we're running at the time, whether it be, you know, a particular survey or a petition or a news story that we want people to get out there. So we provide multiple opportunities for people to engage with the Australian Conservatives or with myself, both in the written word or through this podcast. And if you'd like to subscribe and you're not receiving it already, please go and sign up at coreybernardi.com. It's so simple. Just put in your name and your email address, and we'll make sure that every Wednesday you get updated with your weekly dose of common sense. And the feedback we get from that is extraordinary. It goes out to hundreds of thousands of people. The extended readership is even more. And I just hope that people are heeding the message, because our country needs it more than ever. And we're going to talk about some of the influences, I guess, some of the things that are going on that we need to make people aware of so that we can hopefully change it or hold government to account, or if necessary, put some people into parliament who are going to restore some common sense. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about Captain Cook's first landing in Australia, government spending plan. We're going to discuss your say, or provide the feedback on your say. I'm going to be responding to that, and the ever popular things that make you go, hmm. Plus, we might have another couple of surprises. But before I do, I want to make one point. A lot of the feedback we get from people is that the podcast is a bit too long. Well, you know, there's lots to go through, and you don't have to listen to it all. You can listen to what you want to. But one of the tricks is, if you're listening to it on your iPhone or your Android phone, just play it at 2x speed. It's perfectly understandable. I think it is anyway. And you get through it in half the time, but you get all the information, and that's what's critical. And speaking of information and critical information, did you catch what the government has announced this week on education? Gonski 2.0. Gonski 1.0 was where they threw $23.5 billion into education with no outcomes. There was no measurable statistics about whether that money was going to be spent well or not. But now, when they said the detail will come later, the detail has come later. And it is basically another experiment on your children's brain. Gonski 2.0 is an abandonment of common sense education in favour of unproven concepts that is going to cost us a fortune, $23.5 billion, but I believe it's going to achieve very little. Now, you know, at the time when the government wanted to put $23.5 billion into education without any measurable outcomes or statistics or any real goals, I was one of the few who took the principal position and said, this is stupid. Give us the goals, give us the metrics, give us the ideas before you can sign off on this. The other crossbenchers decided to negotiate an extra $5 billion of borrowed money to throw in this bottomless pit to get non-results or more of the same results. Anyway, the Minister Birmingham said, oh, it'll come later, trust me. Well, later has now come, and here are some inconvenient truths. It is an extraordinary decision by the government to tamper with or have another experiment with our education system. Now, our education system has been dumbed down to such an extent that almost every student in it currently wins a prize. I can't imagine any child who even turns up failing year 12. They will get an ATAR that would get them into university simply for turning up virtually. That's what it seems like to me. And there are subjects that would never have featured in an educational program that you can get into university on. I know of one student who effectively got a university entrance ranking in a subject which was entailed learning the rules of sporting games. Learning the rules of sport is qualification enough to support your entry to university. I think that's just absurd. But rather than tackle the decline in standards through a return to the foundations of education and, might I add, some rigorous student-teacher accountability, it's now proposed by the government that students should be able to work at their own pace, because that way the little darlings won't have their feelings hurt by dropping behind their peers or failing to reach the standards and levels that are expected of them. Now, these are basic literacy and numeracy standards. These are basic educational requirements so that they can engage with the world with some concept of who we are as a people, our position in the world, and the basic building blocks of education. So rather than get a giddy up from the teacher or being able to discipline an unruly student, each child is on their choose-your-own educational adventure. Apparently, according to Gonski 2.0, this is going to allow teachers to focus on the personal needs of every student. Imagine a teacher with 100 different children in their class over the course of the day is suddenly going to have to provide 100 different tailored, personalised programs for those students and monitor them. It doesn't make sense. I suspect you're going to find that the less motivated students will simply fall further and further behind, because there is no benchmark for them. There is no competitive edge. There is no motivation for them to actually do better unless they're motivated internally. Now, this approach has already led to this chorus demanding that we have more teachers and that our teachers need to be paid more because of the important role that they play. Well, yes, they do have an important role. There's no question about that. But unfortunately, too many of them are failing in that role. Now, you see, getting into teaching actually requires one of the lowest tertiary entrance scores imaginable. You can barely pass. In fact, you don't even have to pass, and they'll still allow you in to train to be a teacher. And when I say train to be a teacher, unfortunately, even teachers will tell you this, that basically you go in there, you're indoctrinated with Marxist propaganda. You get wild gender theories thrown down your throat that you have to regurgitate to your future students. And you get alternative history lessons, denying the reality in favour of some sort of black armband view of history, or reinventing communism as some sort of acceptable political system whilst dismissing the hundreds of millions of people that it's killed over the time. All the while, you're undermining capitalism and Western civilization and Christianity. That's what teachers tell me goes on at teaching school. And when you look at some of the programs that come out from state governments and are at work in our schools, like the Safe Schools program, why would we be surprised? But I'm the first to admit there are some amazing teachers out there. So we have to recognise that they do an incredible job in motivating and encouraging students. Unfortunately, there's just too few of them. And those who are really motivated to do the best thing by their students and to get the outcomes that we desperately need have this external challenge placed upon them, that you've got to comply with this PC framework. It's a poison that is working within the system to dumb down the educational outcomes. And the failure of the education system is being felt by our students, and it's been reported in our declining world standing in the education ranks. So the kids aren't expected to get the basics right, because, you know, that might challenge them too much. Because if they've got reading difficulties, why should you make them feel bad about that and remind them? Just keep passing them and pushing them along, because, you know, ultimately it should work itself out. Well, it's not. Reading, writing and arithmetic is the building block, the basics of the education system. And if it's not right, then everything else is going to be failing as well. And university lecturers have told me that year 12 graduates are the equivalent of, say, a year 9 educational standard of years ago. So there is something absolutely wrong. And, you know, at the risk of sounding like a parent, back in my day, you had 5 year 12 subjects that you chose. And there was exams only. You were assessed on the outcome of those exams on your abilities. Now, the really smart kids, the really, really smart kids, got 450 out of 500. It's about a 90%. And that got you qualified you to, you know, maybe for entrance into medicine or something. If you got 400, you would be deemed a smart kid and you would be able to get into physio. If you were a bit of a dunderhead like some of us, or you didn't work very hard, you'd got less than that. But nonetheless, it was a competitive mark. You knew where you stood. And those who wanted to really get into the science-based subjects like medicine had to go through a pretty rigorous and regular program. They had to do a maths, they had to do a science, they had to do an English in order to get those sorts of outcomes. Now, as we've reduced that competitive pressure on the kids, as we've reduced the requirements for them to do the basics, the sciences, the mathematics, and the English, is it any coincidence that the educational outcomes have declined? Everyone can get into university now, but many of those going to university shouldn't be there. They're not equipped to deal with it. They're not going to graduate. They're going to accumulate further debts. They're going to become disassociated because they've been nursed along through an education system that has not prepared them adequately for it. And rather than admitting not every kid should go to uni, we're pushing them in a direction that is not doing them or the country any good. And so the government has admitted it's got a problem, right? And so that's a part of finding a solution. But then they've gone with this ham-fisted approach of Gonski 2.0 that is not going to deliver the outcomes that we need. It's another experiment. It's a soggy indulgence and a flawed notion that children should be able to choose their educational path. We're adults. We're responsible for educating them. We should be choosing the path and helping them to get the very best out of themselves. Now I want to put this in common sense parlance, to put it as simply as I possibly can. The goal of the government is to achieve the same standards of education that were evident so many years ago. So if you want to achieve what was being achieved so many years ago, isn't it common sense to actually return to the system, the methodology, the ideas, and the techniques that delivered those results? Surely we can learn more from the history of our education success than we can by experimenting built on failure. I'll be back.
Enjoying your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi? You need to get on board with the Australian Conservatives. Go to conservatives.org.au and join the party.
Welcome back. I wonder how many of you actually can tell me the date that Captain Cook first landed on Australian soil. Now, plenty of you will probably know that it was in 1770. Those of us who had the benefit of a non-experimental education would have learnt that in our history classes. But it was actually the 29th of April in 1770 when a Lieutenant James Cook, a botanist by the name of Joseph Banks, and their crew on the tall sailing ship HMS Endeavour made their first landing on Australian soil. It was at a place which is now known as Kurnell Peninsula in Botany Bay. And Cook first named the bay Stingray's Harbour. We can all guess why, I'm sure. But later renamed it Botany Bay after Banks retrieved an incredible range of unique botanical specimens from the area. And Banks became famous for his botanical discoveries, his documentation, and later on, of course, was Sir Joseph Banks. And Cook's expedition was really the culmination of a three-year exploration. He rounded Cape Horn, which is on the southern tip of South America, to observe the transit of Venus at Tahiti. Now, isn't that something that sounds really romantic? I mean, I'd love to see the transit of Venus at Tahiti in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, particularly in the middle of winter. It'll be wonderful because it'll be warmer there. Anyway, Cook was also commissioned to search further in the South Pacific for Terra Australis, a legendary, rich and great southern land. Aren't we all happy that the legend proved to be true? But after finding, circumnavigating and accurately mapping New Zealand, he confirmed it wasn't Terra Australis, and he continued to sail west across the Tasman Sea. And he first sighted the Australian continent near Point Hicks before turning north and mapping the coastline until sailing into Botany Bay around 10 days later. Now, I think it's incredible the accuracy with which these early explorers could map coastlines. Given the technology, the lack of knowledge about the local area, they did an extraordinary job, I think, of mapping coastlines. And if you look at some of the early maps, you just recognise how accurate they are. Cook and his team saw the first Aborigines near Borley Point, which is between Ulla Dulla and Bateman's Bay, a beautiful part of Australia. And Botany Bay was where Cook and his crew first made contact with the local Gweigl tribe. Now, I hope I've done that justice. So, Cook's expedition was the first recorded observation and landing of the east coast of the Australian continent by Europeans. It also kicked off Britain's interest in Australia, sowed the seeds for our eventual settlement, it sowed the seeds for our Western Christian traditions, and it's led to this amazing and incredible nation, Australia. Cook's leadership, his mapping, and his discoveries, both scientific and geographic, helped to develop Australia. It helped expand the British Empire, of which our roots are formed, both here and across the globe. We're right to celebrate Captain James Cook, and those who want to knock him and desecrate the statues that are erected to this pioneer of this great nation should be ashamed of themselves.
If you hate political correctness, you're going to love this. This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Welcome back and thanks for staying with us. I want to talk briefly about something that should be important to all of us, and that's money. In particular, how government spends your money. Now, in recent weeks, we've seen the Treasurer do an about-face, if I can put it like that, where last year he was committed to the big spend, big tax budget, where they were putting Medicare levies on, they were raising taxes, as well as doing a lot of off-balance sheet expenditure. Now, off-balance sheet expenditure is where the government borrows money, it spends money, building things that it says is an asset rather than an expense. The NBN is an example of that. The NBN, of course, was going to cost $5 billion when it was first conceived, and it morphed up to $20 or $25 billion. It's now costing something like $50, maybe even $60 billion. And they say that's an asset. All right, mark my words. At some point in the future, they will sell the NBN and they'll get about $40 billion, maybe $30 billion for it. So they'll write off $20 or $30 billion of your dollars under the guise that that's been a good investment. Now, it might be a worthwhile infrastructure project, but please don't hide it off the balance sheet. That's Labor's trick, and that's exactly what they did. But the Liberals embraced it too. On the inland railway corridor, which could, of course, be built by private enterprise for a fraction of the cost, but the government says they're going to do it for about $10 or $11 billion. Borrowed money, I reckon it'll cost more than that, but it's off the balance sheet, so it doesn't show up as a part of the deficit. The same with the second airport at Badgerys Creek in Sydney. The government knows that no commercial contractor wants to build it because they can't make money off it, but the government's going to build it anyway off balance sheet. So it's borrowing money, it's spending money that it doesn't have, and it's pretending that it's an investment. Now, government doesn't have a good track record in these spaces, but nonetheless, this year, the Treasurer seems to think that he's the fiscal conservative all of a sudden. He's dropped the Medicare levy, principally because he can't get it through the Senate. He hasn't even tried, to be honest. And he's also said that he's going to commit that government taxation receipts will not rise above 23.9% of GDP or gross domestic product, meaning that if they tax more than 23.9% of gross domestic product, they'll return the balance to the taxpayer. Seems reasonable to me until you actually look at the figures. I mean, in 2010-2011, the taxation receipts as a percentage of GDP was 19.9%. Now, government spent much more than that, but it was under 20% of the economy in taxes. Imagine how much freer and more liberated our economy would be if government today was spending or taking in tax less than 20% of the economy. Of course, we'd have to do away with a whole bunch of idiotic spending. If we could live within our means, our economy would be that much better off. But since then, the following year, it went up to 20.8%, and it's basically been going up ever since. It went to 21.8%, then 22.5%, 22.9% is expected next year, 23.4 the following year, and 23.8. And that's just under the self-nominated ceiling that the Treasurer has put forward. They want to take basically a quarter of the economic prosperity of the country and, what, continue to run deficits. Coincidentally, when he reaches his self-described cap, we're expected to have a $7 billion surplus. At that rate, we will spend 100 years paying back the debts of the last 10, 12, 14 years of bad government. It's not good enough. If we want to unleash the real productivity in our economy, we've got to get less people dependent on government, more people empowered to go out and work, and we've got to give them the best possible incentives we can, which is allowing them to keep more of their own money in their own pocket. It's the only thing that works. It's the only thing that is going to be sustainable. And it's time that the government put away the sophistry, the smoke and mirrors, and pretended we were going to do all these great things and said, we are the party of lower taxes, fiscal responsibility, and let's end the boondoggles and the waste. It's a tough message to sell, but the Australian people desperately need to hear it, and they need to be told that this is in the national interest, not just for them, but for the next generation as well. I'll be back.
Like what you hear? Support the Australian Conservatives at conservatives.org.au.
There's a couple of stories I've read this week that have made me go, and they might make you go, too. Let me know what you think about this. A Sydney Muslim woman has told an appeal court that she suffered a miscarriage of justice as she was not allowed to give evidence about her terrorism raid lawsuit with her face covered. According to her lawyer, the deeply held religious beliefs of this woman, Musha El Zahed, meant she did not give crucial evidence about her version of what police did during the September 2014 raid. Now, she lost her civil action and was ordered to pay $250,000 in police legal costs. I wonder if they've been paid. She's challenging the trial judge's ruling that she could not give evidence while wearing a niqab. Well, good on the judge. The niqab has no place in Australian society. It has no place in our courtroom. But her then lawyer told the female judge it was against her religion to reveal her face to men. As well as claiming the judge erred in not letting her give evidence in a niqab, the lawyer said she should have been allowed to testify in another method, such as a screen that revealed her face to women, but not to men. This is bordering on the absurd. I hope it makes you as unhappy as it makes me. The lawyer, Mr. Kirk, acknowledged the parties had been in deep and substantially uncharted waters, noting there was only one other Australian case in the WA District Court. Mr. Kirk said two police officers testified at the hearing as to what happened in the bedroom at Ms. Elzahed's house during the raid, so her version was always going to be crucial. Well, if it's crucial, she should have done it. The fact is, the lawyer goes on, we're dealing with very important issues here about a witness giving evidence and about due respect for religious beliefs. Well, you can have your religious beliefs, but it doesn't mean you should be able to hide your face from the rest of the Australian community, from the court of law, and opt out, effectively opt out of being a productive citizen of this country. I don't know too many people who wear the niqab who can get a job. And so you're really choosing to set yourself apart. That made me go,
Like what you hear? Support the Australian Conservatives at conservatives.org.au.
Now, picking up on a theme about women in disguises, as we heard just about Ms. Elzabad, there were some fearless Iranian women who are defying their government, but this time with fake beards and wigs. These women, they're female football fans who donned fake beards and wigs to attend a major match in Iran, in defiance of a ban on women spectators. And they've been hailed as fearless by activists on Monday. Good on them. Photos and videos of the fans sitting in Tehran's Azadi Stadium, disguised as men as they watch their team crowned champions on Friday, have gone viral on social media. The Islamic Republic of Iran, you know, that's the one that Barack Obama did a deal with, gave billions of dollars to and allowed them to develop a nuclear industry that the Israelis are saying are developing a nuclear bomb. Anyway, the Islamic Republic, which represses people, has long barred women from attending male soccer matches and other sporting fixtures, based at least partly, and I'm quoting here from a Reuters report, on the theory that women should not hear fans swear. But one of the Iranian women's rights activists, a lady named Melody Safavi, I'm very proud of them, she said, and I'm impressed they can be so fearless because it is a huge risk that they do that. They are trying to break a lot of lines and taboos. For other people, it is a small step, they go on. But for us, it is a big step because the cost of this action is not small. They risk being arrested and ending up in an Iranian gulag. Anyone who thinks that an Islamic theocracy protects the rights of women, of minorities, of gays, protects civil rights, protects freedom of religion and freedom of speech has got to have rocks in their head. That made me go, I hope it did you too. I'll be back.
This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Welcome back. This is your weekly dose of common sense podcast. My name is Corey Bernardi and we are getting into your say. And what a bundle of material that's been sent to me this week. If you want to contribute, send me an email, corey@coreybernardi.com. If you want to send me a voicemail in a .wav file or something similar, we can probably play it on the air and respond to it as well. That's my first step in trying to make this as engaging as possible with your voice on it. Anyway, earlier this week, I got an award for supporting vaping in Australia. Now, vaping is a harm minimization method of delivering nicotine to nicotine addicts. It's like a patch. It's like a chewing gum. But this time you sort of heat it up and inhale it. It's 95% safer than smoking cigarettes. It's legal all around the world, but it's not here in Australia because some people just think we don't want it. Well, I think it should be because it's going to save lives. It's going to help people get off smoking. And one of those people was Nathan. Nathan said, thank you for standing up for common sense regarding e-cigarettes. I've been a pack a day or more smoker for 23 years. I've tried everything to give up. It is now nearly 6 months completely tobacco cigarette free, and I've reduced my e-cigarette intake to almost zero because of vaping. But Nathan, unfortunately, you're breaking the law by doing this. How absurd is that? You're trying to save your life, and you have to break the law in order to get off cigarettes. The government is mad to be banning this. Not only could they legalize it, they could make money off it from taxing it, but the more people that were vaping instead of smoking cigarettes, the lower the hospital bills would be. Because the Royal College of Physicians in the UK have said it's 95% safer than cigarettes. 19,000 people die prematurely of cigarette-related illness in this country every single year. Vaping can reduce that. It's absurd. We need to get some common sense, so get in touch with Greg Hunt. Anyway, Jeff writes, evening, Corey, great podcast. I know you have talked about preferences, but I still believe it is going to trip some people up. One thing that people, including me, until I found the right article, probably didn't know that if your primary vote doesn't get up, I'm going to paraphrase this, Jeff, all your votes go to party two or in the next preference and so on until someone gets 50% of the vote. It's true, Jeff. It's true. Unfortunately, under the compulsory preferential system, if your first choice doesn't get up, then your votes will flow to your second choice, and so on and so on and so on. And it means in some absurd circumstances, your vote will actually count towards Labour Party or the Greens or another party that you just have nothing in common with because they're your worst option. I think we should have voluntary voting. I think it should be optional preferential voting, and I reckon it would deliver a different outcome. Anyway, we can talk about that another time. Hi, Corey. This is Peter. I've been a lifelong supporter of the Liberal Party and have had to part ways because the coalition is lost. One thing that concerns me is the allocation of preferences at the next election. Nothing could be worse than Shorten becoming the next PM. Amen to that, Peter. So I want to know, while voting for your organisation, allocation of preferences will not harm the coalition's chance of winning the election. Well, Peter, as I said, firstly, every individual allocates preferences themselves. In the seats that we're going to be running in at the federal level, it's likely we're going to be directing preferences to a Conservative candidate ahead of a Labor or Greens candidate. But let me tell you, our goal is the checks and balances in the Senate. I would rather see a coalition government too, but you can't trust them because, as Michael Sukkar has said, they're full of termites. And they're eating away at the pillars that have traditionally upheld this centre-right government. The only way you can stop that is to vote Conservative in the Senate. If we can get enough votes and get enough senators elected over one or two elections, we can hold the balance of power and restore some common sense to government. We can anchor them to where they're meant to be. About lower taxes, stronger families, personal responsibility, fostering free enterprise and rebuilding civil society. That's the challenge. Now, Terence has ticked me off a little bit. He's said, is it by chance possible to change your column from weekly dose of common sense to something more respectful? It's because it hurts one's sentiments that the reader is dumb and only the commentator is intelligent. That's why a dose of common sense had to be injected every now and then on issues of importance. Well, Terence, I'm not going to change the name, mate. I'm sorry. I don't want to offend you and make you feel dumb, because that's the least of it. But the fact is, I'm trying to distill and disseminate some common sense information because you don't get it anywhere else. It's an unfortunate reality. You can read the newspapers, you can watch the news or what passes as news today, and it's just not common sense. They take one particular slant on things and refuse to acknowledge a whole range of other stuff. So this is a haven. A haven from the fake news. It's a haven for those who recognise there's something going wrong with our country and we need to fix it. We identify the issues, we talk about how we can fix them, and we want more people to spread the word. So sorry, Terence, don't feel dumb, feel enlightened. The fact that you've got a haven of common sense every single week to retreat to. Father John, he's written me an email, says, that's what I like about your policies, Corey. They're all the issue from the one centre, which I can only call your integrity. Therefore, they are integrated. Thank you for your integrity. Don't ever let it go. Well, Father John, thank you. I'm not sharing the rest of your email, not for any particular reason other than there's some, some personal stuff in there. But I want to say how much I appreciate it, and it's coming from a man that I respect very much. Now, speaking of men that I don't respect very much, there's a guy named Mohammed El Mueli, who Nola has written to me about. He says that Mohammed El Mueli claims he runs a halal certification program, which he says earns him $13 million. I'm not sure if that's per year or to date. As you know, the ATO says there is no profit made from halal certification. I didn't know that. Apparently a Senate inquiry determined this. I'd like to know when this inquiry was conducted and how deep did anyone look into this scam. Well, Nola, I initiated the Senate inquiry. It was a few years ago now. There was never any suggestion that you weren't allowed to profit from halal. There were claims made by some registered charities, such as Muslims Australia or the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils, that said they only operated on a cost recovery basis, which was not true. I demonstrated that. But you're going back to a 1981 report, a Royal Commission, I think it was, that suggested it only be done on a not-for-profit basis. And it's got nothing to do with the ATO, to be frank. But it is a scam. Mohammed El Mueli is a big part of it. He's been caught out in the past not telling the truth. He's been caught out. He's admitted to bribing officials. And he baits everyone on Facebook. I don't have any respect for him. Nor should you, Nola, is my view. And finally, Frank. Frank has said, it's high time the ABC is privatised as it no longer serves the purpose for which it was originally intended. Well, I agree with you, Frank. It no longer serves the purpose for what it was originally intended, which is balanced news reporting. We understand at the moment the federal government is looking at various ways of funding the NDIS. Would it not be an opportune time to privatise ABC with a resultant savings directed towards funding the NDIS? You go from one bottomless black hole to another, but at least you wouldn't have the propaganda that goes with it. So thanks for your suggestion, Frank. Our policy on the ABC is on the conservatives.org.au website. I'd encourage you to go there and have a look. And for everyone else, please send me an email, corey@coreybernardi.com. Let me know about what you think about the podcast. Let me know about the issues you want me to address. And if you want to put them in a voicemail, you can do that and send it through too, and we'll try and get it on the air. I'll be back.
You're listening to your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.
Well, that's it for this week's Weekly Dose of Common Sense podcast. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've certainly enjoyed presenting it to you. And we've gone over time, but unlike the government, we've come in under budget. Thanks for listening. Speak to you next week.
This is your weekly dose of common sense with Corey Bernardi.